I'm going to talk about marriage tonight. This is my Labor Day sermon because marriage is work. You don't find your soulmate. You become soulmates by working at the relationship. And we have an extensive discussion about marriage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that we'll be looking at this evening. We'll be doing an expository lesson from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But marriage is as old as man. Marriage was instituted by God in the morning of time there in Genesis chapter 2 on the sixth day of creation as God made Eve, custom made to fit, to be a helper suitable for Adam. And it was for the good of one man and one woman in a lifetime of a loving commitment. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 4, Jesus said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife." And that shows that the marital relationship transcends the parent-child relationship. "And the two shall become one flesh." It's the total commitment of the total person for the total life. You have one new life in two persons. "So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate." That is, God's ideal is to make marriage work. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. Marriage is not a disreputable institution. People like to trash that, make jokes about it. There are people that think that marriage is obsolete. Marriage has not been tried and found wanting. It's been tried and found difficult. That's why we need to look at God's Word to guide us. "For fornicators and adulterers God will judge." Understanding what the Bible says about the importance of marriage is very important. Because people that go into marriage, people that fell in love at first sight, wish they'd taken a second look, they get into a marriage and they say, "I don't like it," and they just abandon the marriage and get out, and then enter an unscriptural marriage due to unscriptural divorce, or living in an adulterous relationship, and it says that God will judge adulterers. And in fact, 1 Corinthians 6 says that adulterers, among other sins, will not inherit the kingdom of God. And also we see in Hebrews 13 verse 5 that the physical or the sexual relationship is to be lawfully joined in the marriage relationship. Yet, marital problems are a major cause of conflict, unhappiness, and divorce. Someone said the difference between a nightmare and my marriage is the nightmare is eventually over. Years ago, I read this statement in Reader's Digest. Marital distress has become one of the top mental health problems in this country. Why is that? Well, because it's one of the most intimate relationships. You have two imperfect human beings with different personalities, different backgrounds, different blind spots, and they come together in the most intimate relationship, and it's inevitable that you have some kind of friction. So you need some guidance to how to guide and mature the marriage. What Every Family Needs, which is a good practical book on marriage, the family in general. Selfishness is the greatest single enemy of a happy marriage. In marriage, it's no longer me, but we. As Paul talks about, the mutual agreement and consideration that you should have in marriage. So the Corinthians wrote Paul several questions that were troubling their marriage. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we'll turn there. Now, Paul says, "Now concerning the things which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband." So you have an extensive discussion here about God's will concerning marriage relative to the questions that they had asked. They were being troubled, we'll see, by some that taught that celibacy was a holier state and they ought to separate. Because he says repeatedly, don't separate, three times. So that was the question relative to marriage that he was dealing with, along with other things. So Paul, by the Spirit, and he affirms several times in 1 Corinthians 7 that he has the Spirit. He gives spiritual guidance to answer our questions and to bless our marriages. So when you have problems, what do you do in marriage? You fuss and fight? You could talk to a marriage counselor as long as it's within the confines of biblical principles. This husband and wife, they're fighting, and this woman said, we're just fighting all the time, and what we need to do, let's sit down and pray, and pray the Lord will take one of us, and then I'll go live with my mother. And that's what happens. We rely on our own ideas. We need to look to the architect of marriage. God wrote the original marriage manual. 2 Peter chapter 1 in verse 3, Peter says, God has given us all things that pertain unto life and godliness. All things. Relationships and marriage. Okay, we're talking about verses 1 through 9, marriage and the physical relationship. Paul responds to the Corinthian aesthetics that it is good for a man not to touch a woman. I believe that's a quotation from the letter. In response to, he says, he keeps saying, don't separate. Verse 5, stop depriving one another. Well, they were taught to separate, to be celibate. Verse 10 is to not divorce your husband. Don't separate. Verse 12 and 13, he says, don't separate. So it seems like he's answering a question that is that, well, is it really good for a man not to touch a woman? Is celibacy a holier state than marriage? In fact, that's what's taught in the Catholic Church, that priests cannot marry because of this alleged idea that celibacy is a holier state. And the Bible doesn't teach that celibacy is a holier state. And in 2 Corinthians 11, they were becoming, really, he says, enslaved to these. They were Jewish teachers, some false teachers. They seemed to have a Jewish background. And that was troubling the Corinthians. So what is Paul's refutation of this? He says in verse 2 that because of immoralities, that is sexual intercourse or fornication, each man is to have his own wife. It means to continue to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. So God designed monogamy for the lawful enjoyment of the physical relationship. That's God's idea. And in the church, this is something that's sort of always a delicate subject. And you can turn to the book of Song of Solomon, for example, and it talks really extensively about the physical affection and interaction that they should have in the marriage relationship. And, of course, that has to be taught in a discreet manner because you have different people, different ages, and that kind of thing. But, you know, for example, when we had a class on marriage, after you say I do, we surveyed Song of Solomon, and we had one class with men in the class, and then the women were in a class, and talked about this very question about the lawful enjoyment of the sexual relationship in marriage. And that's the way God designed it. Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 19 says, be enraptured with her love. So the sexual relationship was not merely designed for procreation, as is taught in Catholicism. It is for the mutual enjoyment and intimacy of the husband and the wife. Husbands and wives owe each other mutual affection, understanding, and support. Look at verse 3. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife. That word, their duty, means a debt. To his wife. Mentions the husband's first, he's the leader. And likewise, also the wife to her husband. Marriage is all about meeting mutual needs. Anytime that we start thinking about, if the other person would just straighten up, then everything would be great. Well, in any marriage relationship, there's always two sides to every story. It may be your problems are 50-50. It may be 90% one, 10% the other. Whatever percentage is your percentage that you need to resolve, or whatever need that needs to be met on the other one, resolve that you'll do that instead of just waiting till they straighten up. And then our marriage will be better. There's mutuality in marriage. Verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And that's the idea that the husband and the wife belong to one another. Likewise, also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So they both owe one another the best possible physical, affectionate interaction. It's not to be one-sided. And there's different books that you can read. And again, every book that you might read by man has to be evaluated through the biblical lens. But Willard Harley wrote some books called His Needs, Her Needs. And also he wrote a book called Love Busters, The Things That Destroy Romantic Love. And understanding His Needs, Her Needs, as we saw in the book of Song of Solomon, that the five major needs of men and the five major needs of women are different. And one of the things that causes problems in marriage is not understanding the difference between the needs of men and women. The number one complaint of men about their wives is their wife is not physically affectionate enough. The number one complaint of women about their husbands is my husband doesn't communicate. He doesn't want to share, like he cares, he understands. And so both have to work at that to make marriage work. Let's see. Kevin Lehman wrote a book called Romance Begins in the Kitchen. And one time I was loading the dishwasher, and Debbie walked into the kitchen and she says, "Woo, you look good." So understanding what happens, the husband said, "I want my wife to be affectionate to me, for me," and then she has all kinds of work that she does, and she feels sometimes overwhelmed. And if she would just like the husband just to be sensitive and help out, so she doesn't feel overwhelmed. The wife, because maybe she's not as interested in the physical relationship as the husband, is that he still has a need. And if that need's not met, that's going to cause frustration on his part. So in the marriage relationship, I just encourage you to read through the book of Song of Solomon and read that together. That's a good family project to do. It helps you to study the Bible together and to show about the physical intimacy that God wants in marriage. Marital problems should be resolved by mutual prayerful consent. He says in verse 5, stop depriving one another except by agreement. And for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So he talks about the importance of marriage is mutuality. If you're going to resolve the problem, you need to communicate and come to a common agreement of a common course of action of how are we going to resolve this problem. And that you're going to pray about it. In the King James and New King James, it has the word fasting there, but that's not in the best manuscript. So one of the best things that you can do in your marriage is husband and wife, they can pray together. Pray in the morning, like when you send your kids off to school, or just pray in the morning after they've gone to school, or pray at night before you go to sleep. And I know of couples that helps intimacy, the idea of the spiritual priority that we should have in our marriage, that everything we do has a mutual impact on one another. Verses 6 through 9, Paul says, but of this I say of concession, that is to separate or to be apart physically by agreement. That's a concession, not a command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I am, that is they could be single or celibate. However, each man is his own gift from God, one in this manner, another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I am. Being single in the church can be a good thing. We should not look at single people in the church as they're sort of a fifth wheel or they're sort of, you know, out of pocket. The Apostle Paul was single. Jesus was single. So there's great things that single people can do in the Lord's church. But being single is not required. Verse 9, but if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry, and that is scripturally marry, than to burn. That is to burn with lust. So Paul says that the physical relationship is to be lawfully enjoyed in the marriage relationship. Then he talks about marriage and divorce, verses 10 through 16. But to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not leave her husband. And this is in the context some were teaching, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, that is to be celibate. But if she does leave, this is contingency legislation. She must remain unmarried, that is unmarried to anybody else, or else be reconciled to her husband. So notice that if she leaves, the word there, leave, in the original, aphiemi, is used as a technical term for divorce in the papyri, which is the Greek writings of the first century. But notice that God still considers them the husband as being married to him. Being married to her, I'm sorry. So they're still married in the eyes of God. Even though in the eyes of men you can be unmarried, they're still married or bound in the eyes of God. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. Okay. Paul affirms Jesus' teaching of one man, one woman for one lifetime, that they should stay together. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6 says, what God has joined together, let no man separate. Malachi 2:10, God hates divorce. Because marriage is a lifelong covenant that is pledged before God. And the frivolous way in which marriage is treated in our society is shameful. In 1900, the divorce rate in the United States was 7%. In 1950, it was 18%. 1975, it was 46%. 1993, it was 51%. And it's leveled off since then. It's a little under 50%. In that number, that includes people that have been married and divorced maybe before. But the idea is that we have the highest divorce rate of any country in the world. So it is a trivialization of what God says about marriage, about the lifelong commitment. You go into marriage and say there are no escape hatches. We are going to make this work. And it forces you to be committed, to live by principle and not live only by your feelings, how you feel or your moods at the particular moment. And so there should be mutual commitment to make the marriage work. There's contingency legislation. It says if she does leave, verse 11. He didn't say that it's okay because in verse 10 he said don't do that. In southern Indiana, when I moved there, I was surprised. There were brethren that believed, well, it's not wrong to get a divorce as long as you don't remarry. Verse 10, he uses the word leave, which was a term for divorce, separating of a marriage. He says, don't do that. So it is a sin to get an unscriptural divorce. Now, if you sin, what do you do after that? Well, you remain unmarried or you reconcile. That's why it's called contingency legislation. Now we come to what's called a mixed marriage. Mixed marriage. And this is verse 12 and following. To the rest I say, this is a believer and an unbeliever that are married, not the Lord, that is Jesus did not specifically address the question about one's a believer and one's an unbeliever. Jesus taught Jews, and the Jews would both be believers in God. And in fact, in the Old Testament, in Ezra and Nehemiah, when Jewish believers had married unbelieving Gentiles, they were told to separate. And we're going to see this as something different than Old Testament legislation. He says that, and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. That's different than what they did in the Old Testament. And the woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away, that is, divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife. Now, how is an unbeliever sanctified by the believer? Does that mean that they're saved? No, it means they are set apart in a lawfully recognized marriage. God sees them as married. Now, there are some that teach that an unbeliever is not amenable to the law of Christ. But this is one evidence to show that if a person is a non-Christian, but they're married, God recognizes that. And they are amenable to the law of marriage. Marriage did not begin with the ministry of Jesus. Marriage began at the dawn of creation. So he says that they must not divorce. And that he is sanctified or set apart in a lawful marriage. The unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean. That is, if you weren't recognized as being married, your children would be considered illegitimate. So the children are in a legitimate marriage. But now they are holy, set in a legitimate marriage. Now you come to, he says, stay in the marriage since it's recognized by God. Then you come to verse 15, divorce. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, this particular word is another word that's used for divorce in the papyri. They leave. They abandon the spouse. Let him leave. That is, you don't have to force yourself on them to stay in the marriage. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. There is the idea that if they depart, that you're not in bondage to them, you're not bound to them anymore, and since you're free, you have the right of remarriage. The problem with that, when he talks about bondage, he's not talking about the marriage bond or tie. He's talking about enslavement. Paul doesn't even talk about remarriage until verse 39. This particular word comes from deluo, which means to enslave. The Christian spouse should try to make the marriage work, but they are not enslaved to the unbeliever by abandoning the Lord. Verse 15 says he's called us to peace to save the marriage. Stay together, make the marriage work, but if they abandon you, and presumably that may be for religious reasons, you try to save the marriage, but you don't abandon your peace with God in order to maintain the marriage. The marriage bond, Dio, a tie, to bind, is not the bondage here that Paul's talking about. The word bond, you're not under bondage, is in the perfect tense. The perfect tense means past action with abiding results. You are not now in bondage and you never were in bondage. Now I know some people think that in marriage they have a hook through their nose, but Paul says that marriage, you are not in bondage. If you're married, you're not in bondage to one another. You are bound together in the marriage tie, but you should not be in bondage to one another. For you to abandon your faith in the Lord to stay with an unbelieving spouse would be enslavement to men. And Paul talks about, and later on he talks about not to be enslaved to men. Verse 23, for you were bought with a price, and do not become slaves of men. Don't be in bondage to men. Your relationship to God transcends your relationship to others. So remarriage is not in Paul's purview until 7:39. He's simply answering the question of what the current situation was. That they are to stay together, make the marriage work. However, you're not obligated to make the marriage work to the point that you are in bondage and give up your peace with God. Paul goes on to say, verse 16, for how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? In other words, by staying true to your commitment to God, you can be an influence to persuade them to maybe be converted. I heard of this young Christian woman. She was married to an unbelieving spouse. She had a little baby, and she always went to church. I went to church regularly 3 times a week. The husband, who wasn't a Christian, would sit home, and he didn't like that. So he went and he disconnected a wire so his wife couldn't start the car because he wanted his wife to stay home. She went and started the car, it wouldn't start. And so he said, well, I disconnected it because I want you to stay home with me. You're my wife. And she said, well, no, I'm going to go to church. So she started walking. Took the little baby and started walking to church. The husband felt bad about that, went and reconnected the wire, went and picked his wife up, took her to church, was later converted and became a preacher. You can, by your influence, you can save your husband. That's what 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1, that your unbelieving spouse can be won by a word, won without a word, by your influence. Now he talks about what seems to be a diversion, but I think in context, all this has to do with marriage. And let's read verse 17 and following. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each one, in this manner let him walk, and so I direct in all the churches. Was any man called when he was already circumcised? He is not to become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? He is not to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Each man must remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about this. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Someone was teaching them that they were to be dissatisfied with their relationship, or their social economic situation. Brethren, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called. Now, this may relate to married couples, and it may relate to single couples as well. But Paul is saying that if you're married, that you are to be content with your position in life, whether socially, a Jew or a Gentile. And one of the major problems that was in churches in the first century, you had Judaizing teachers that were telling Gentiles, the circumcised, that if you want to be right with God, you need to be circumcised. That was one of the major doctrinal issues in the first century church. So there were Gentiles that were felt bad about, well, I'm uncircumcised. And the Jews said, well, you need to be circumcised to have a right relationship with God. Also, you had slaves in the church. Now here's a couple that's they're slaves, and here are free couples. Don't you think a slave would like to be free? And I can imagine they would say, why can't I be free? This isn't fair. And what does he say? He says, you abide in the condition that you've been called. If you were a slave, you need to be content with that. You know, the gospel did not come to bring about social revolution, but spiritual revolution by converting people. And the byproduct of that was the eventual abolition of slavery. Now, there are some practical applications of this that, as you apply to married couple, of being satisfied with your lot in life. One thing that happens is you become distracted with other things that take away from your spiritual relationship. For example, there are young couples that get married and they grew up enjoying the fruit of the labor of their parents that their parents had worked and saved for many, many years. They're used to having a lot of things. And then they go off on their own, and when they get married and they're not making as much money, they are dissatisfied by having to take a step down economically. And so there's a temptation with all the credit card offers that come in the mail to become overcommitted, to get in too much debt. And financial problems is one of the major sources of conflict in marriage. And so if you have to, when you first get married and you don't have as much as maybe other people or as your parents had growing up, you have to learn to be content with that. Like one time, it's funny what kids will say in Bible class. Someone told me this little boy in Bible class said, my mom says that my dad is lazy, which is why we don't have a nicer house. And it wasn't too long I was talking about contentment and materialism. And I said, you know, if you can't afford a house, that's no shame of living in a trailer. The mother of that little boy refused to talk to me after that. I would ask her, what's wrong? Why? And she said, I don't want to talk to you about it. So somehow I hit a sensitive issue. She wanted a bigger, nicer house. And her husband wasn't making enough money, and she wasn't going to have it. And she was mad about it. She was dissatisfied about it. Paul says, whether it's economic or social, don't worry about that. That the most important thing, he says, is keeping the commandments of God. Now, Paul isn't saying stay in an unscriptural marriage. Abide in that condition. He's talking about circumcision and uncircumcision, slave or free. He's talking about social or economic conditions, not an unscriptural marriage. Because that would contradict about keeping the commandments of God. Jesus said the only scriptural reason for divorce and remarriage is fornication in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. Now you have marriage in the current distress. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 25. Now concerning virgins, that's the never married, I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. So he's going to give some inspired advice, some things that you don't have to do, but would be preferable. Verse 26, I think then that this is good in view of the present distress. They were in some kind of strait or constraint that made being a Christian difficult. It could have been persecution. You know, if you get married and you happen to belong, say if you're converted and you're in a trade guild that has a patron deity, as a Christian, you could no longer go to that idol's temple and worship that idol. You'd have to quit that job. You know, in Ethiopia, the young men generally don't get married until the late 20s or early 30s because they have to save up their money in order to support their wife and their family. To get in a situation where they wouldn't be able to support their wife, that would cause distress and problems. So there was some kind of persecution that made being a Christian difficult. And he said, to remain as he is, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you, the man, marry, that is married scripturally, you have not sinned. He says it's preferable to stay in your situation. But if you are single and you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin, this is the woman, marries, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life. And I am trying to spare you. So Paul's saying it's better to wait. Christians should always weigh earthly decisions in light of the eternal impact on the soul. He says in verse 29, this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on, those who have wives should be as though they had none. And those who weep as though they did not weep. And those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. And those who buy as though they did not possess. And those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away. Verse 32, I want you to be free from concern. He's saying when you make decisions, well, a lot of times we make decisions how we feel at the moment. And he says you need to make a decision not based on how you feel at the moment, but you need to see it in light of eternity. In eternity, we're not going to be married. We may be happy in the present. We may be sad in the present. But you need to look at the long-term consequences. And again, that's like, for example, young couples who want to elope and get married, and yet how are you going to support yourself? I remember watching Dragnet when I was a little kid, and Joe Friday talking to this hippie couple. And I think they had been arrested for shoplifting or something like that. And they had eloped and got married. And he said, well, you didn't have a job. How did you expect to support yourself? And he said, we were going to live on love, man. Yeah, and that too. But, you know, he's saying here that you need to realize this world is passing away. And maturity is the ability to make decisions in light of its impact or its consequence. So Paul advises then in verse 36, let's go on down in verse 32, but I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. So in the present distress, you're going to have some conflict in providing for your wife and being a Christian when you may be faced with persecution or you may be faced with a hard time keeping a job because of compromising your Christian faith. In verse 36, he says, if any man, and this would be the father, thinks that he is actually acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter. And if she has passed her youth, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let her marry. The father may be thinking in the present distress, I must forbid my daughter to marry. Well, if she's set on it, she's getting older, she really wants to be married, go ahead and let her be married. And then finally, we have marriage and remarriage. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. That word they're bound is dio, a tie. It's not that word deluo, bondage, that Paul used in chapter 7, verse 15. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is, that is single. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. He gives some advice, not a requirement. Death severs the marital tie. That's what Romans chapter 7, verse 2 and 3 say, that you're married or bound as long as you live, but once you die, you are free. So marriage is not going to be in heaven. In the Mormon church, they teach that you have celestial marriage. In fact, you're going to be gods, and you're going to populate your own world. You have all these children. The Bible says that marriage is something that's only for this age, and that we're not going to be married in heaven. Widows may remarry only in the Lord. The question is the person in the Lord, or is the marrying in the Lord? I believe this is an adverbial phrase that modifies the marrying that is in the Lord. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Now, children, obey your parents in the Lord, does that mean obey your parents only if they're Christians? What does it mean to obey your parents in the Lord? To obey them in harmony with the Lord's will, what's pleasing to the Lord. So the marrying has to be in the Lord. It is, obviously preferable to marry a Christian. It's highly preferable, but it's not necessarily sinful if it is done in the Lord. There are those that have married a non-Christian, and they were sorry they did, but you can't separate. That's what he says in chapter 7 because of the differences in the spiritual views. But if you go into a marriage and that the spouse, the partner, is amenable to, supportive of your total commitment to the Lord, there have been several couples, I can tell you, that converted their unbelieving spouse. It depended on the understanding you went into in the marriage and the priorities that are demonstrated in the marriage. But it's obviously preferable to marry a Christian. So God wrote the original manual for success in marriage. And we can bring our questions to God's Word and follow it as we come to follow God.